Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of this channel. Today we'll be talking to Zoltan Pal about his new book, Salafism in Lebanon, Local and Transnational Movements. Zoltan, welcome to the show. Perhaps you can start off by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Hello, I'm Zoltan Pal, and currently I'm a research fellow at the Middle East Institute at the National University of Singapore. And I'm an expert on transnational Islamic movements, and my focus has been especially on Salafism. Salafism in the Middle East, in Lebanon, Kuwait, and also I have researched the movement's transnational ramifications in Southeast Asia and Europe. And I just recently published a book on Salafism in Lebanon, which is a result of about 10 years process of research and writing.
Perhaps you can talk a little bit about what your educational background is, but also I know that you have a almost unique way of researching, certainly in Central Asia, which you do by bicycle, and maybe you want to talk a little bit about that. And also, as you've done your research for your book, you've encountered difficulties, and perhaps you want to touch on that briefly.
Well, my educational background is by profession, I'm an anthropologist, but my master degree, up until master, I studied Arabic studies, Arabic language and literature at Eötvös University in Budapest. And after receiving my master degree, I continued my studies in the Netherlands, where I completed my PhD in social anthropology. And well, I consider myself as I mean, I would say that I'm working, I'm using a multidisciplinary method of research, which mainly is based on ethnographic fieldwork, which means that I have done the research for the book, I spent years on the field in Lebanon, but also several months in the Gulf. And while I was staying in Europe, I extensively traveled to Germany and Sweden to uncover the Lebanese Salafis' transnational linkages there. And I followed a few Lebanese Salafis from Lebanon to Europe and observed their career path during several years. Well, and it's good that you mentioned the bicycle. Yes, actually, my hobby is cycling, and I like touring with my bike, meaning that I basically use it as a mean of transportation through several countries that that I visit, and I actually, while cycling through Malaysia, Indonesia, and other countries, I observed that cycling is also a way to establish contacts with people, connect easier to. I observed that locals are welcoming cyclists. So for this reason, it was much easier for me to interview people, to have informal conversation with people in Malaysia, Indonesia, but also in Cambodia. So actually, my project my project of using bicycle as a means of research is still in the stage of experiment. But whenever I have time and can get away with my bike for a few days somewhere, especially to a Muslim country or a Muslim area, I'm trying to utilize it gain more data and gain more experience how to connect cycling to ethnography.
You sparked a lot of curiosity because you're this white guy on two wheels in areas where they don't see that very often.
So usually what we researchers, the one of the main difficulties what we researchers face is that they so people tend to mix us up with security agents. So it means that sometimes, you know, when you arrive, let's say with a bus or a taxi or a plane to a certain area where you want to conduct interviews, well, initially people are suspicious about you. They think that actually you disguise yourself as a researcher, and in fact you are collecting data for CIA or Mossad or any kind of Western intelligence agency. Now, they can't imagine a white guy with a bicycle to work for a security agency. I mean, this is somehow just not... not in their imagination. They can't imagine a CIA agent arriving, you know, with a bike, sweaty, you know, cheap T-shirt and a cheap short or trouser. So I think my image is different. So they think that I'm just some kind of weird guy who also might be interesting. So they themselves actually usually look for talking to me and seek contact.
Yet that didn't stop you from getting expelled from Lebanon.
At that time, I wasn't with bicycle, so yeah, I was expelled from Lebanon. until today, I don't really know why. I mean, I have some clues, but I don't have an exact answer. Once actually, I wanted to do field work, I flew to Lebanon and I was stopped at the airports, and they just told me that they won't allow me in, and I have to leave with the first flight. I was also detained for a couple of hours in a cell. So until today, I don't know why this happened. I mean, I have some ideas, but no 100% accurate information.
Would you want to share those ideas?
Yeah, I think it's most probably what I heard from a friend of mine, a Lebanese friend of mine, is that he made some informal investigation and he found that most probably an officer, an immigration officer, just wanted to show that he's doing something and wanted to appear prominent. So he raised a case against me, which eventually didn't stand. So the immigration authorities found out that there's nothing on me. So they canceled this case. But it didn't. This cancellation didn't happen before I was expelled from the country.
And have you been back since?
Yes. I've been back end. There was no problem.
Okay, let's take a step back and tell us a little bit how you got, or what sparked your interest in looking, first of all, at Salafism, and second of all, at Salafism in Lebanon.
All right. So immediately after finishing my master in Arabic studies, I became a journalist. So I was a foreign correspondent for a Hungarian daily paper, which was called Népszabadság. Unfortunately, this used to be the biggest daily paper in Hungary, but a few years ago, it was closed. But that time, it was flourishing and was very popular, and I was proudly writing for this paper. I lived in Beirut, and I was sending articles and analysis on the political situation in both countries, in Syria and Lebanon, in like between. I was working for this paper as a correspondent, foreign correspondent, in between 2007 and 2009. Mm-hmm. And while exploring Lebanon as a journalist, I realized that certain transformations are going on in the country's Sunni community. I bumped into several Salafis, especially when I was traveling and wandering around the Sunni villages of the north. I realized that there are certain sheikhs who are more respected by the local population than others, and they happen to spread a kind of literalist vision of Islam. And then I found this interesting. That time it was still a small movement, but I expected that it might actually grow into prominence, especially because the sociopolitical situation was given. So around 2008, I started to look for a way into academia. And I sent a proposal, research proposal to the Netherlands, and based on this proposal, I received a 4-month fellowship to ISIM in Leiden, which was a prominent institution for research.
Yeah, that was the Institute for Modern Study World. Of Islam in the Middle East.
International Institute for Study of Islam in the Modern World.
In the modern world, yeah.
And so I spent four months in that institute, and I had a chance to discuss with several members and researchers of that institute, and so there I came into the conclusion that there is still a huge gap of literature on Salafism, and no one has written anything serious on this movement in Lebanon. So during these 4 months, I actually prepared a PhD proposal, a more serious research proposal on Salafism in Lebanon, which was accepted. And I got several fellowships in Holland, which allowed me to pursue my PhD studies and receive my doctorate degree.
You talked about, but you didn't elaborate right now, just now, although you do obviously do that in the book. But maybe you can do it now, about when you were a journalist in Lebanon and you observed not only that some Islamic scholars were more popular than others, but that you were noticing transitions in the country. Can you talk a little bit about those transitions and the role that Salafism or more literalist interpretations of Islam played in those transitions?
Yes, well, of course, one of the most important developments for Salafism was the withdrawal of the Syrian army from the country. So this is what you mean, right? The political developments after 2005.
Well, more than probably yes, but I was referring to the transitions that you were talking about in your initial answer. which I probably
there was a gap in the Sunni community, like a vacuum of authority. So after the withdrawal of the Syrians and the collapse of the so-called Syrian Lebanese security regime, a gap emerged. Salafis became free actually to proselytize, so they didn't face that much oppression anymore. And at the same time,
if I can interrupt you, just so we fill in listeners, the Syrians intervened in 1976, if I'm not incorrect, in the Lebanese civil war, and they were there till after the 2005 assassination of Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, and that's when they were withdrew, and you had a substantial change in Lebanon, correct?
Now, also, serious political tensions emerged between different players of the Lebanese political field, especially between the Sunni-led Future Movement, which is basically a political party that emerged around the late Rafik al-Hariri, and after his assassination, his son Saad al-Hariri. And on the other side, Hezbollah. After the Syrian Hezbollah intended to increase its participation in the Lebanese government, many Sunnis actually became frightened. They imagined that Hezbollah might try actually to dominate the country, and this was a fertile ground of Salafists to actually frame the situation according to their own discourse and worldview, and they packaged this into the frame of a kind of Manichaean struggle in which there is a conspiracy which has been going on since the first century of Islam, and now it's culminating in Hezbollah, Iran's and Hezbollah's attempt to take over not only Lebanon but the whole Middle East. But Lebanon is one of the playgrounds, aside of Iraq, for instance, or Bahrain.
Just to be clear, I mean, you know, people make various categorizations of Salafism. Perhaps the most important one being between those that are called quietist, with other words, They're non-political, they don't engage in political activity, and more activist interpretations and groups. And I assume that we're talking in Lebanon, the groups that you're talking about, those were more activist.
Both networks or both streams can be found in Lebanon. The activists became definitely stronger, but the quietists are, or what I call them, purists, are of course still present and are still significant. These streams are or networks also have different donors, different supporters who are based in the countries of the Gulf. Now, do you want me to elaborate basically what's the difference between them?
No, not necessarily. If you want to, of course.
Yeah, well, I mean, just in brief, of course, as you mentioned, the quietists, they mainly focus in religious practices. They usually, if they engage in politics, they usually do this for securing their own autonomy. So, for instance, the purists in Lebanon supported certain candidates during the 2009 elections in order to get support from politicians and also kind of political cover. to be able to continue their activities. Well, the activists, they more likely engage in political activism and also social activism. They still want to create a society based on Salafi principles, but they also use the tools of party politics for the sake of transforming society. And the one important aspect of the difference between these two streams is that the purists believe that the ruler, I mean, the Muslims have to obey the ruler until he's not openly an apostate. And also Muslim, the ruled are not allowed to criticize the ruler openly, only in secret. While the activists, or harakis in Arabic, they think that the mistakes of the ruler can be corrected also publicly.
You talked about how, in a sense, the Syrian withdrawal from Lebanon gave them momentum. Can you talk a little bit about what the impact has been of the Syrian civil war on Salafi activity in Lebanon?
Yes, well, it had grave impact, as of course the Syrian civil war has influenced tremendously the political life in Lebanon, and different segments of the Lebanese society took different sides regarding the Syrian civil war. So, for example, the Shias, who are perhaps the largest sectarian group in the country, stood beside the regime of Bashar al-Assad, while the majority of the Sunnis supported the opposition, which was also overwhelmingly Sunni. Now Hezbollah also militarily participated in this conflict, and also several Sunnis themselves, Lebanese Sunnis, fought with the opposition against the regime. The Salafis, officially they supported the opposition with both political and material tools. I mean, for instance, financial tools, or helping Syrian refugees, sending different goods, technical assistance, etc., to the opposition. And at the same time, the conflict in Syria gave impetus to Salafi discourse, which projected the opposition of the Sunnis and the Shias in a certain religious cloud. So the Salafis often argued that what's going on in Syria is one of the signs of the end of times, when Muslims are fighting an unbeliever army. So and this battle is, or this war is taking place in the Sham region, which is basically the historical Syria that includes Lebanon, Syria, contemporary Syria, Jordan, Palestine, part of Iraq, and the part of Turkey. And so basically the Salafi preachers gave a plausible explanation for many people what's happening.
You earlier put this development partly in the context of a sectarian divide between Sunnis and Shias, which automatically takes you to the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran, in which Lebanon has always been a battlefield. Can you elaborate a little bit on that and the role of the Salafis in that?
Often people like to draw direct links between the Salafis in Lebanon and Saudi Arabia. Well, this is not, this is a little bit more complex than that. Indeed, Saudis used to be, or Saudis always have been one of the major, if you like, sponsors of Sunnis and supporters, transnational supporters of the Sunni confessional group in Lebanon. But most of the Saudi finances don't go to the Salafis, but for example, the official Sunni religious establishment, Dar al-Fatwa, which is definitely not Salafi, although you find Salafis among them, but the majority is more traditionalist and Sufi-oriented, or support goes to the Lebanese politicians, and maybe a fragment of support to the Salafis. In fact, if you look at the Lebanese Salafi scene, as I actually explain in my book, the major financial donors are Qatari and Kuwaiti charities of the Salafis. While it doesn't forbid the Salafis to take side to take side in this rivalry, as many of them look at Saudi Arabia as the larger Sunni force, as the best bet to save, if you like, to save the to Ahl Sunnah or the Sunni community from the Shi'i conspiracy. But I mean, I wouldn't dare to say that Salafis are agents of the Saudis, because this wouldn't be true.
You talk obviously a lot in your book about the whole funding structure out of the Gulf, and you've referred yes. to it also. Perhaps you could talk a little bit more about I'm sorry. Perhaps you could talk a little bit more about that funding structure and what the motivation behind the funding is. And also, I mean, probably less so in the case of Qatar, but possibly in the case of Kuwait, where, you know, funding streams have in a sense changed as a result of post 9/11 crackdown on funding and the way and more control of funding in Saudi Arabia, and to what extent Kuwaiti charities also are a funnel for Saudi funds, or maybe not.
Well, actually, to start with the last point you made, well, I mean, it's very difficult to find like exact or hard data on how much Saudi money is going to Kuwaiti charities or other charities. Well, there is since the Saudi government clamped down on its own charity sector, so definitely many like Saudi ordinary people might actually channel their religious taxes, for instance, or just donations which they want to make for the sake of Muslims abroad. They might channel this money through Kuwaiti charities. So it's quite common that Saudi citizens go to Kuwait as tourists, and that might be possible that they give donations to certain charities. But again, it's becoming more and more difficult now in Kuwait, because previously it was possible to give your donations in the mosques. There used to be certain offices or even just donation boxes in the mosques where you could leave your whatever money you wanted to donate. Now you have officially in Kuwait, you have to make this donation through through your bank account. And well, about this funding structure, so It's actually quite a complex structure. One of the main elements of this are charities. And I mention in my book, I elaborate on two charities, especially two charities. One is the Qatari Sheikh Aid Charity Organization, Charity Foundation. This is this charity is based in Qatar, and it's a waqf, an Islamic religious endowment, which was established by the fund of given by a fund given by one of the members of the ruling Al Thani family. Well, this charity is not an explicitly Salafi charity. They give money to many kind of Muslims to Muslims from different ideological background. For instance, when I traveled in Indonesia, I observed also that they finance modernist Muslims, but in Lebanon, the main recipients are activist Salafis. The other main Salafi charity organization that I mention in my book is Jamayat Ihya Turath al-Islami, or the Society for the Revival of Islamic Heritage. This is a Kuwaiti charity. This is one of the largest Salafi or Muslim charities in the world. It's a prominent organization in Kuwait. It's not only a charity, also a political party that has been representing itself, or at least it represented itself in the Kuwaiti parliament for more than three decades. Now, actually, they don't have a single member because they lost the last elections. And they are present in more than 50 countries around the world, and including Lebanon. They are the main founders of the Purist Salafis. And as I mentioned before, that Purist Salafis, while they are not explicitly political, they focus mostly in correcting religious practices and spreading correct belief, what they actually perceive as as correct belief. They often represent themselves in or they often participate in the political game, simply in order to secure their autonomy, their proselytization. And so charities are the main one of the main channels of funds for Salafis. But at the same time, you have several private donors who might actually even donate informally. Let's say tourists travel to Lebanon and leave some money at an orphanage, at a mosque, or just give a few thousand dollars to friends. Or let's say invest in something, in some kind of business, let's say in opening a restaurant, which then is going to be controlled by Lebanese Salafis.
Would you describe these charities as wholly private initiatives that stay private, or would you suggest that they also serve a purpose for example, the Qatari or the Kuwaiti government in some form or other?
Well, look, in the Gulf, you cannot make a clear distinction between civil society and the insular or the non-institutional political sphere. I would say that, for instance, in Kuwait, well, Ihya Turath is officially private, but they often received support from the ruling family. I mean, the Kuwaiti ruling family. So the political system in Kuwait is parliamentary. So it is officially a constitutional monarchy, which has a quite influential parliament. Now the ruling family uses this parliament to check on the various political forces of the country, and they usually intend to fragment political forces, political parties, play each other play one against another. This is happening in the Sunni Islamic segment of this political field. For instance, in the 1980s, the government supported Salafis, helped Salafis financially and politically to grow in order to forbid the Muslim Brotherhood to monopolize this Sunni Islamic segment of Kuwait's political field. And for instance, currently what's happening is that the government again is supporting Salafis who are affiliated to Ihya Turath. They have provided high-ranking institutional political positions to Salafis, again, in order to counter the Muslim Brotherhood. So in this case, yes, there is definitely a state influence in these charities. Well, in Qatar, obviously, the whole charity belongs to the ruling family, so you can't put private and non-private distinction.
And presumably, the funding structure, as you've just laid it out and detailed it in great detail in your book about Lebanon, is applicable not only to Lebanon but to multiple countries.
Definitely, I mean, of course, there are always differences, but I have made similar observations during my fieldwork in Indonesia and most recently in Cambodia. In the past 2 years, I spent several months in Cambodia, where there is a Muslim minority and one of the biggest actors among Cambodian Muslims is the same Salafi charity, Ihya Turath, that supports the Lebanese Salafis, with dozens of schools, clinics, and other representatives in the country. So yes, you can basically you can tell that this kind of funding scheme exists elsewhere as well.
You talk about in your book also, obviously, about the political environment or the environment in which the Salafis gain traction. I wonder whether you could talk a little bit more about the social economic factors that underlie the rise of the Salafis in Lebanon and perhaps in some of the other countries that you've looked at.
Well, yes, it's a very complex issue. Well, I still think actually that that in Lebanon the political situation is one of the main reasons of the emergence of Salafism. But at the same time, as I elaborated in one of my chapters, the kind of relative deprivation of lower middle class young people is an important factor why Salafis gain traction in the society. They are facing a kind of material instability, an uncertainty of future, in a society which is going more and more to a neoliberal way. So Salafism, with its black and white, clear cut nature, provides something certain in an uncertain world. That if you follow correct Islam, you belong to the elite. You belong to the best of humanity. At the same time, Salafis provide community for these young people, moral support.
I guess in a way, if you look, you know, if you abstract from the religious aspect of Salafism, in many ways, it's what the appeal is of populism in the West to various groups, or why Donald Trump appeals to various groups. It's that same trend of those who feel left out by society or marginalized, and are looking for some framework.
Yeah, but I think it's, well, you can make a very, very rough comparison, but I think that the Donald Trump kind of populism is much more shallow. So at least Salafism has a canon. It has a much more elaborate system, which can be actually also much, much longer lasting than Western populism.
And do you look at the rise of Salafis in Lebanon, for example, and their growing influence within the Sunni Muslim community as something that is temporary, or is that something that we're going to see stay for a significantly extended?
It has been around for quite a while. So it is. I don't think that it's going to last forever, especially in Lebanon. I mean, nothing lasts forever. So this is a country which is prone for rapid changes, especially due to its unstable political and social makeup. But I think Salafism in Lebanon is surprisingly long lasting, and perhaps because of the factors that I just mentioned before. But I can imagine that perhaps another movement or ideological stream gets more traction than Salafism. People might also be disappointed because, providing a certain kind of community and moral support, I don't think that Salafis are able to deliver much of their promises. For instance, one thing is that many Lebanese indeed expect that this kind of apocalyptic war in Syria is happening and the end of time is close. But you know, if let's say there's some kind of closure happens in Syria and this kind of apocalypse won't happen, then you know this is something what the Salafis got wrong.
Right, and obviously they're unable really to produce jobs on a major scale or economic progress, which are really some of the driving grievances.
Yeah, but of course this is one of the driving grievances. But again, Salafis they don't promise, they don't tell that they are going to, that if they are not, they don't aspire to govern the country. They don't promise. What they tell to people, well, if you become better Muslims, then your situation is going to be better because God is going to side with you. Well, if this situation of the Sunni Muslims in Lebanon won't progress, won't get better, Salafis simply will tell, well, we told you, be better Muslims, and then your situation will be better. You will be richer. Your society will be more stable. But then you didn't follow our advice.
Obviously,
so in this case, you know, it's like Salafis on one hand, you know, provide a very easy solution. It's like, you want to better your situation, pray, abandon harmful religious innovations, be a good Muslim who follows the uncorrupted version of Islam. But if you don't do that, so there was an easy excuse because they can tell that, well, your situation is bad because you are a bad Muslim.
Right. Obviously, you know, the popularity of the Salafis, like of any other group, ebbs and flows, and at some point will ebb. But having said that, you talked about the political environment being one of the reasons for the rise of the Salafis. And so the question is, even if they don't engage in directly in government politics or parliamentary politics, to what extent do they have an impact on the politics of the country, as well as... even if they don't convert large masses to Salafism as such, they are a very conservative movement. And do you see, as a result, the Sunni Muslim community in Lebanon becoming more conservative?
Certain segments of the Sunni community, definitely, yes. So if to give you an example, in Lebanon, I met several and I had contacts with several Sunni Muslim young people who drank alcohol, who had an absolutely secular lifestyle. And let's say while having a beer or two together, and some even touched the question of religion, their imagination of Islam was identical to the Salafis. So something which is very sharp, which sets up very sharp boundaries. So to give you an example, these young guys, they liked listening to music, but they admitted to me that any kind of music is haram. It's not permissible by Islam. They are just doing. They are listening to music because they are bad Muslims. So this is an obvious impact of Salafism. At the same time, their framing of the ongoing political tensions and their views on the Shia community was also very similar to what the Salafis propagate. So they also, despite not being practicing Muslims, they also tended to frame the ongoing political tensions between Hezbollah and the Sunni political parties or Sunni political forces in a sharp religious cloud.
I mean, Lebanon's unique in many ways, of course, but one of the ways that it's unique is that it has Hezbollah, which is a very strong popular movement, Shia Muslim movement within Lebanon, which from the longest period of time, certainly prior to Hezbollah's involvement in the Syrian war, was a popular movement also because it was a resistance movement against the Israelis. And many Lebanese credited Hezbollah with forcing the Israelis to withdraw from Lebanon, ultimately militarily. What I was saying is Lebanon is unique in many ways, one of them being the existence of Hezbollah, which is a very popular Shia movement with a military wing that gained a lot of popularity in Lebanon prior to the Hezbollah's intervention in the Syrian civil war, because it was credited with forcing the Israelis to militarily withdraw from Lebanon, and it's fought an X number of wars with Israel since. And of course, it has very strong links to Iran. Does that indeed make Lebanon unique, and does that make the rise of the Salafis in Lebanon unique?
Well, yes, in certain ways, yes, because what the Salafis utilized in order to gain more prominence is definitely the sectarian tension. As you mentioned, Hezbollah was indeed a resistance movement for a long time, but after 2005, it increasingly, and especially after the 2006 war between Israel, it increasingly became a sectarian militia, meaning that it increasingly started to rely on its own community and several because of the ongoing political tensions, because of Hezbollah's attempt to and actually successful attempt to bring down the Hariri government and force itself one-third presence in a so-called national unity government. This kind of move, when the party blocked the Riyadh al-Salh Square, the center of Beirut, alienated many of the Sunni supporters. So Hezbollah ceased to, gradually ceased to be a national resistance movement and became more of a sectarian militia. This tendency continued during the 2008 May clashes when Hezbollah and its allies took over by force downtown Beirut. So when this happened, it became increasingly easier to project these developments as in a frame of religious conflict, sectarian conflict, and move away from being as a purely political conflict. So this definitely made Salafism in a way unique in Lebanon, because in other countries Salafis start with less with kind of sectarian propagation, but by missionary activities, proselytization, and building up their popularity based on a strong core who are actually committed Salafis, and then attracting a larger pool of I would call passive followers or supporters.
One last question related to your book. You described Hezbollah as increasingly a sectarian movement. Salafis, of course, are also sectarian in their own way, often strongly anti-Shiite. So does that mean that we're seeing a spiral of sectarianism in Lebanon?
Yes, that has been going on for a long time, yes.
Okay, well, listen, I think this has taken up a lot of your time, and thank you very much for this. But before I let you go, what I would like to do, Zoltan, is ask you, where do you go from here? What's your next project?
Well, currently I'm working on the Middle East. Middle Eastern charity networks in Southeast Asia. For a while I have been focusing on the presence of Kuwaiti and activities of Kuwaiti charities in Cambodia. And, my next project is, I already wrote a few manuscripts on this issue, and my next project is trying to put together a book manuscript on this. At the same time, I'm also working with my former supervisor, Professor Martin van Bryneson, on an edited volume on Salafism in Southeast Asia.
Both sound like great projects, which we certainly will look forward to. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it and learned a lot, and wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.